From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Gardeners have increasingly heard the call to reduce or eliminate their use of peat moss, the most familiar ingredient in seed starting mixes and potting soils, one that a lot of us have long relied on. But peat is not sustainable, and its harvest releases substantial CO2, a greenhouse gas that contributes to climate change. So what to use instead? That's our topic today with North Carolina State University Professor Brian Jackson, an expert in soilless growing media, or soilless substrates, as they are also called. But first, his message.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, a leading publisher in books that share wonders with the natural world, including A Way to Garden by Margaret Roach. The stunning guide imparts decades of plant wisdom and challenges readers to think beyond their garden borders and to consider the ways gardening can enrich the world. Available everywhere books are sold and at timberpress.com. They invite you to come grow with them.
Brian Jackson is a professor in the Department of Horticultural Science at North Carolina State and director of the university's Horticultural Substrate Laboratory. He's one of perhaps five U.S. scientists at public universities who are studying these materials and their role in horticulture and agriculture. I'm so glad to reconnect, Brian. Thanks for making time today.
Thank you, Margaret.
Yeah, I learned so much working together on our recent New York Times garden column about this subject, and I look forward to learning more today and sharing it with everybody. I know that listeners are going to be eager for your advice, on kind of like what to use this season and what to sow their seedlings in and all kinds of good things like that. But before we get there, I think maybe we should set the scene because, you know, there's current environmental and also economic sort of a backdrop of both here, and it's kind of different in the UK and Europe, and peat's in high demand, but oh my goodness. So maybe you could kind of set the scene. So there's a lot going on. Uh-oh, did I make a big task for you there?
Oh my goodness, it is. And thank you again for the opportunity. What an exciting yet challenging time to be in horticultural production research and to work in an area that involves both consumers of garden products as well as professional growers who rely so heavily on these unique materials to grow our food crops and our flowers and ornamental crops. I guess a brief overview just to get us on the same page is, you know, peat moss as an organic material used to grow, used in potting soils to grow crops, has been predominant since the 1960s. And for the last 50, 60 years has been, as I quoted you, Margaret, the Rolls Royce of growing media.
Yes.
And it is. And so one of the first things, you know, I would mention is, you know, peat moss can never be replaced because we cannot replace anything. Same with us. We can offer alternatives. And I think that's where, you know, this conversation is going and yeah, other publications about alternatives. Peat moss across Europe has been used for centuries as a fuel source, and that's one of the reasons why some of the peat lands in Europe have not been managed as properly as they should have been before.
Right.
Before we knew better, quite frankly.
Right. So, I mean, I remember in the story, you know, quoting only 22% of the peatlands in the United Kingdom, for instance, are in a quote near natural or re-wetted condition, you know, almost 80% of them are in some way impacted already.
Correct. And
yeah.
And one of the other things I think is important to think about in regards to the to looking at peat and its sustainability or its impact on environmental concerns, you know, only 0.05% of peat globally has been used and has been extracted for horticultural purposes.
Right.
The other extraction has been from agriculture, fuel, and forestry that's kind of taken these resources. So therein lies the crux of the problem in Europe is they haven't done it properly from the beginning. So now they're having to really assess peat's use moving forward and how other materials can help supplement and extend those peat supplies. And then in Canada, of course, who supplies the vast majority of our materials in North America, the Canadian industry is younger. It's only 50, 60 years old, give or take. and they're doing things much better from an environmental perspective.
And we weren't harvesting, extracting it to heat our houses. That was never the purpose.
Exactly. That's
right.
Correct.
Right. Okay. So, and I remember again, statistic wise, Canada, I think, has an estimated 27% of the world's peatlands in terms of acreage, but 0.03% of them are currently
correct.
Harvested or have been harvested. So again,
correct.
I don't think you are. We're not trying to like greenwash this or anything and say, oh, hey, nope. In fact, it does. Every time you extract peat, it does release a substantial amount of CO2, and there's no getting around that.
It's just that
we're trying to say perspective wise, hopefully the Canadian industry has been doing an okay job so far, and we'll see. And they're not going to stop harvesting, are they? I mean,
they're not, Margaret. And that's a great point. There's a lot of initiatives that they're taking to minimize or to mitigate their environmental impact and carbon emissions. But there is some that happens. So they're working hard to try to do the best they can. And that's true for any other material that we use has some impact. And we're all trying to mitigate that to the best of our abilities.
Right. Now, in the UK, though, there are bans that are coming up for instance, horticultural products, for, you know, garden products, and eventually for commercial products. There's timelines for stopping the use of peat in those products and so forth. And they're already on that timeline,
yes,
I think.
Yes. Ireland was the first to ban peat extraction in 2020.
Right.
The United Kingdom, including all four of its nations, is set to limit or to actually stop peat use in the hobby market in 2024, and then the professional market by 2030. And there are seven or eight other countries in Europe that have some level of conversation or regulation in mind,
right,
about how to address this moving forward. It's certainly a critical issue, certainly as growing media and different growing media types are so important in how we grow food and other crops for the future.
Right. So it's a time of very high demand and a time of environmental awareness converging to make a very complicated kind of moment.
It is a perfect storm. You're
yeah. Correct. Yeah. So you're in the business, or, you know, the research business of researching soilless growing media or soilless substrates. So tell us what a substrate is, because you got all the lingo, you know, you scientist types. And what are the other materials besides peat in that sort of palette, you know, of soilless substrates?
Yeah, great question. You know, and a substrate is just, you know, basically a material on which something grows.
Uh-huh.
And some people, if you know, taking microbiology, you use a substrate in a little petri dish, you know, to grow cell culture or something. So substrate, we always use the word soilless or horticultural in front of that, but it is potting soil, potting medium, growing mix.
Okay.
So other than peat, thinking organic materials, carbon-based materials, of course, you've got the coconut products coming out of the Philippines and Sri Lanka and South India and Mexico, coconut coir, as it's called, compost. You've got bark, aged and composted barks. You've got rice hulls. There are a lot of different organic materials that are being used in soilless media. And then you've got the inorganics, those that are not carbon-based, like perlite or vermiculite or rock or stone wool or clay pebbles. So there's a quite decent sized palette of these different ingredients that
right.
for 50 years we've formulated some really unique mixes.
Now, before the 1960s or whatever, before peat became the Rolls Royce, was the commercial, you know, where potted plants and so forth, was it soil, actual soil that was used as the medium? I mean, was that what things were potted up in? Or was it just because it was before the giant mechanization of the greenhouse industry and the mass production of plants and so forth?
Yeah, great question. Yeah, it truly was, you know, when people started growing crops, plants in containers, and in the early days of containers, they were actually egg cans and other like commercial food grade cans that were used to grow plants, metal cans. And it's really fascinating, the history of the container or the containerized system that we now have the options. It's really fascinating. And most of the time they used mineral soil, field soil to fill in these pots. Okay. And they quickly realized that based on the weight, think about a 1 gallon pot of sand or soil. That is right. So heavy. And then the water, it's like a bathtub. It holds so much water. It just doesn't drain properly. So yeah, it was soil that was used predominantly before a sand peat mix, and then more and more away from the sand, and then discovery of these other lightweight, sterile or beneficial organic materials.
So if we start to get practical, that sort of how-to-er stuff, you are at North Carolina State, a tremendously important university for horticulture and agricultural research and so forth, and training the future, you know, experts in these fields. Do you have like greenhouses full of like mad scientist experiments with trying all kinds of media and, you know, and comparing these tomatoes to those tomatoes and these petunias to those? I mean, is that kind of what's going on, trying to figure out, hey, what else can we use? Is it that way? Is that where the research is done?
Yeah. Have you looked inside of my greenhouse?
Apparently I've seen the mad scientist at work.
You have. So, you know, the great thing about research is you can get creative and really think outside of that proverbial box we always talk about, and really think about, you know, what are some new options? What are some things to do? So we test so many different materials through a battery of different procedures and analysis techniques to assess their potential in growing plants in different systems, and making sure that what we are doing to formulate new materials and new mixes is not only adequate for plant growth, but it's also economical, and it also is recyclable or can be reused. So there's a long list of 50 years of research that's kind of gotten us to a point of how do we evaluate new materials from start to finish? And it's really not, we don't really throw the kitchen sink at this in regards to how to approach the science behind development of new products. It's a really detailed list of parameters that's been developed over the years that give us a higher level of success when we're looking at a new material, for example, hemp fiber or miscanthus or other biomass crops that may have potential as soilless growing media components.
I've even seen, like, you know, on the market these days, you know, products that are labeled as substitutes for potting soil or for seed starting mix that are like made of like paper, recycled, like newsprinty type of paper, and all Absolutely. Kinds of things. I mean, it's like lots of ideas out there.
There are. And thanks to the article recently in the Times, Margaret, I've been, you know, contacted by a lot of folks, and what I have learned, and one of the great things about this contribution that, or this collaboration, I have learned of companies and products on the market in the United States that I have never heard of. And it's not to say that they aren't relevant. It's just right. There's a lot out there in this big country of ours. So I now know of companies and products that are peat alternatives, that are completely peat free and have been for a number of years and are being very successful. So I've been encouraged by the number of the development that's went on. And I didn't know about it, which, again, that's not to say that I know everything by no stretch of the imagination, but
no.
We're further along than I thought. So I think this article right. has helped open that perspective up.
Right, because I looked, of course, you know, longingly over at the UK, where, again, the bans are impending or in place, and for horticultural products. And, you know, and I saw that the Royal Horticultural Society already had branded a whole line of potting soils and so forth with a particular company. And, you know, I was like, oh, wait, can we have those? but no, we didn't yet. And so what we do have is we have some smaller innovative companies and some medium-sized innovative companies and people trying things. But here's the thing, and this is what I want to spend some time asking you about, because you, again, have the experience hands-on in the lab, in the greenhouses and so forth, doing the research. And you're actually also trying to not make sure I can grow my seedlings, little Margaret with her couple trays. You're talking about the entire industry. And as you pointed out, that's an industry that it provides the potting media for our food, many of our food crops. And, you know, it's Absolutely. Not just like, oh, Margaret's going to have a couple of little petunias over there. You know, it's a big deal. It's massive, the basis of our agricultural and horticultural production system. So I'm hearing from a lot of people who, and expert gardeners, friends I've known for a long time, who are serious good propagators. You know, they grow lots of different things. And they're saying, well, you know, I tried such and such and everything died, or I tried this and my seedlings were stunted. Or, and then another person calls me and says, the same product and they did great with it. So it's like, oh my goodness. You know what I mean? It's not like it's the map is, you know, is all figured out. We got to do some experimenting. And I just wonder, where do we start? Because in the Times article, we talked about how maybe we sort of warn people, maybe your seedlings, the most vulnerable babies, maybe you don't want to throw everything at them right away. Maybe you want to go slowly with those. So tell me, where would you begin helping a gardener like myself, like the listeners, you know, in making this transition, if they wish to, for environmental reasons, to be environmentally conscious, you know?
Yeah, great, great point. I would say, and this is a really neat point that you brought up, for how we develop professional mixes to grow to provide the really large greenhouses and controlled environment, vertical farm, nurseries, for those materials have to go through different criteria, and there are different expectations of them than consumer hobby market products.
Yes.
So even from the article, you hear people say, well, I've used this and it works great. But think about a 100 acre greenhouse, or think about 5,000 acres of greenhouses that need 500,000 cubic yards of the same material. That's where things get really challenging on that scale. So,
yes.
So it's a really neat point, thinking of the consumer home gardener who wants to make that choice. You know, even I wish I could go back and us do the article again, because I could shed light on other product development that there are peat alternative options that even for seed starters apparently are really quite good. So I would advise to do one's homework, as is always is a good thing to do before trying something. And maybe there are products you could either order online and have delivered to you, but then, you know, thinking of sustainability, how does that factor in as well?
Yeah.
Or what does your local garden center have, and what is the opinion of the experts at that garden center as to what products they could either order in or could perhaps request that are peat free? Because, you know, there are options out there. So start slow, do one's homework. Do not expect that, as we mentioned in the article, that any new material or new approach to doing something is going to be the same as what you've always done, because there may be nuances. So I think those are the places that anyone can start. And then asking yourself, you know, is this product that I'm using, is it worth the price, or is it truly better than peat? And you know, that's a conversation that we can continue to have and that will continue to evolve as we move forward.
Yeah. So, okay. So it's like, say I'm going to start, and this is, again, I have a number of friends who are all in this sort of experimenting stage and have expertise and are successful seed sowers or successful, whatever they're growing in pots and so forth and trays. And what they're doing is, and what I'm going to do this year, as we've talked about before, you and I'm not going to just stop using. I always used, you know, I have a brand from Johnny Selected Seeds, the Johnny's 512 mix. That was my thing. I know how it feels. I know how it works. I know how it handles water. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I have the feel of it. And correct. I made that analogy. It's like the first time I tried a gluten-free flour, the cake was a disaster. And, do you know what I mean? Cause like, I didn't know what I was doing and it wasn't a one-to-one substitute and blah, blah, blah. And it wasn't as moist and oh my goodness. So, you know, that was my thing, but I want something that has that type of result. So what a lot of my friends are doing and what I'm thinking of doing is kind of not, if I have, you know, six flats going, filling them all with some unknown material that I've never handled or worked with before, but maybe doing one experimental flat with a couple of, you know, like a couple of six packs of something in it, but not losing all my crops if I don't have a good experience. Does that make sense to you? Like, are you doing it gingerly too when you're experimenting?
It does. And I think one of the other things that I would highly suggest is to read the label on any new product, because Margaret, if your traditional go-to brand that you've always used, which maybe is a peat perlite mix, for example, if it has some type of starter charge nutrient in it that perhaps a peat alternative product doesn't have,
Right.
And you need to make sure to know that, just so that you're not expecting the same thing, not only, as you mentioned, from the watering front, but that also that you're not under or over fertilizing those very sensitive young plants. So
yes.
If you want to look at
yes.
the nutrient charges in them, and yeah, just you know, buy a small bag and just compare it to the others before you going big scale. And understand that there may be differences. Maybe you like it better or worse, but also be willing to adjust your practices.
Yeah, I'm thinking of adding, like trying to extend my, I have a part of a leftover bag of my 512 mix. And I'm thinking of, you know, maybe I'm going to add some coir to it or, do you know what I mean? I'm thinking of like gradually feeling my way through it in a sense.
Yeah, and what we may find, thanks to technology and thanks to advancements in product development from big and large companies that even I don't know about, as referenced earlier, there may be some products that there are no learning curves, and that's even better. And I think through sharing and through platforms by which we educate each other, that we begin to help everyone understand kind of what the current options are.
Right. And what I'm hearing from friends, you know, the ones who are working in greenhouses, like at public gardens and stuff like that, are having a different experience with their experiments than the ones who are just a home person with a couple of trays. And, you know, there's different environments, different humidity, different temperatures, different air circulation. I mean, a lot of different factors that are going on that can, I think, impact success with any growing medium.
Yeah, it's a great point. It's like for the companies that I work with on retail hobby market products, also think, are you growing in upstate New York or are you growing in the south of Florida?
Right.
And that makes an individual product used in two different locations perhaps very different as to how it behaves. So also, think about your location as well in regards to temperature and sunlight and humidity and cloudy days or sunny days, and all of those things factor in as well.
Right. So one of your, we have, you know, maybe 4 minutes left or something, and one of your greatest areas of, you know, the greatest depth of expertise or what you've been exploring are wood products. And I always, for potting bigger plants and so forth, I always used a bark-based mix. Doesn't mean it didn't have peat in it, but the primary ingredient was bark-based, and you know, it was a little more textural. You're working with and researching and trying to figure out how we can use a renewable resource, wood, in various forms, not just bark, in soilless mixes, right? Is that the direction that's going to make up some of this great demand and allow people to maybe reduce their peat use too? Is that where it's going to go?
It truly is, Margaret. Globally speaking, engineered wood fibers are viewed as the most probable and likely raw material that is immediately ready or will be ready to fill that void of an increased demand as the peat supplies may or may not be limited moving forward. And I know a lot of your listeners may be thinking, well, you can't grow plants in wood. Wood robs nitrogen. Wood is bad. But you know, propagators, primarily in California, have been using sawdust and propagation of woody plants for since the 1940s and 50s. But only until the 1980s did products of truly used wood fiber, not bark, but the actual white wood itself. And products have been on the market for a long time, but really didn't gain interest until about 7 or 8 years ago for all the reasons that we've discussed. So I started looking at engineered wood fibers in 2005 as part of my PhD work, and it's my lifeblood as to what I am focused on. And there's a lot of potential for engineered wood fiber, even in consumer products that likely are already in some products that growers or users may not know about. But there's a lot we need to learn, but there's a lot of potential in true non-composted wood fibers.
It's very exciting. I mean, I actually think this environmental awareness and all of it, I mean, it's going to lead us to really positive developments in a lot of ways. And it's exciting. And I'm so glad to learn from you and to talk to you, Brian Jackson from North Carolina State University. And just, you know, I always like to go to the scientists as opposed to the marketers of commercial products when I'm asking the question. And that's why we started where we did. And you're right, maybe we have to do a follow-up piece before long about some of the products that are out there and what we've both learned. So I really appreciate your making the time to talk with me.
Margaret, thank you so much, my friend. It is a pleasure.
Okay.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, the leading publisher in books that share wonders with the natural world, including A Way to Garden by Margaret Roach. The stunning guide imparts decades of plant wisdom and challenges readers to think beyond their garden borders and to consider the ways gardening can enrich the world. Available everywhere books are sold and at timberpress.com. They invite you to come grow with them.
And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you again soon. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.